History isn't just a bunch of names and dates and facts. It's the collection of all the stories throughout human history that explain how and why we got here. Welcome to the History Unplugged podcast, where we look at the forgotten, neglected, strange, and even counterfactual stories that made our world what it is. I'm your host, Scott Rank. Malcolm, welcome to the show.
Great to be here.
This is an interesting topic, and Nazi plunder is something that I think a number of people have at least passing familiarity with. There's been a few movies released in the last decade or two where Nazi plunder was featured in the central plot, like the George Clooney movie Monument Men, where a group of historians and researchers are trying to get in front of the Red Army and get these precious artifacts that were originally captured by the Nazis and return it to the original owners. Or there's the Spike Lee movie, The Inside Man, where this bank heist, the bank robbers are trying to get these Nazi diamonds. So for you, as someone who's researched this topic professionally, and you're also personally dealing with your own family history, where do you think this fascination with Nazi plunder comes from?
It's an interesting question. I think when you talk about Nazi plunder, I don't think you can easily separate true, real, let's say, coins, diamonds, gold, art, what we would call like literal plunder, from the myth. And I think it's such a rich myth and really has taken a hold of the cultural imagination for a very long time. And that's, you know, it happens in the cultural space with the movies you mentioned. And it happens also in like the contemporary Poland. So I dealt with a lot of quote-unquote Nazi treasure hunters who were after plunder, who were after, let's say, Nazi artifacts and gold. But there's also a tremendous amount of, let's say, curiosity and imagination. So to me, I sort of broaden the question a little bit and talk about, they call it mystery, what they're after. So that's kind of any open-ended question. And that could include stuff like Nazi infrastructure, so like underground tunnels, or let's say questions of like what happened in this battlefield, or let's say undiscovered concentration camps, to more literal, like more material gold, or questions of lost arts, or something called the Amber Chamber. And I think it's just one of these, I think just the Nazis as a topic are just so rich and imagination taxing. And there was so much that was lost and that's unaccounted for. And this is just one of these things that there seems to be like a bottomless curiosity about, like, where did all this stuff go?
Right. And what's still out there? What could still be found? Before we get into your personal story, could you describe it to me in general? How did Nazis plunder treasure or precious artifacts? As the Wehrmacht is moving out, does a soldier stumble across something and then this is reported up the chain of command and then another team comes in? Or did they already know about the treasure and it's extracted with surgical precision? Or do you know in general how this works?
Yeah, I mean, there's a big range. It somewhat depends on the country. It somewhat depends on local cooperation. A lot of it was just done at a bureaucratic level. So they'd come in and seize, let's say, museum assets that would just be sort of taken, very often sent back to Germany. There was a tremendous amount of many private citizens, particularly Jews, but not only Jews, had to surrender their assets. So including gold that was often taken, seized by the state, and often, again, sent back to Germany. A tremendous amount of looting was happening at the lower levels by soldiers or by officers. And there was just a tremendous amount of opportunity, I would say, with this much movement and demographic change of populations getting moved, people losing their homes, people losing their properties, not being granted the right to take much with them, a tremendous amount of opportunity. So it would also happen at the local level when people, they saw the chance to take it and they took it. And a lot of stuff was hidden. So that would be include sometimes by Nazis, but sometimes by people who had their property seized from them, but attempt to hide it. So there's just a literally endless amount of stories about people hiding their maybe it's their gold or their diamonds or their assets or their cash in the walls or in the backyard or in the attic. And again, you never know if these stories are true, but certainly a number of them are, and the vast majority were never recovered. And so the question is, who found them? And so again, then you have just people looking today, like a range from sort of hobbyists who will go around with metal detectors. And I will say from the outset, I'm most familiar with Poland. That's where I did most of my research. And then you have more, when it moves up the chain, even sort of sponsored search parties with much more sophisticated equipment. And they're looking for, again, anything from old machinery to lost artwork.
Before getting into your personal story, as you were researching this, as you were in Poland and talking with people, were there any other stories that stood out to you of family heirlooms or other things being hidden that were later recovered that were surprising?
That's a good question. I mean, even in my story, even in my family story, we have a story that my great-grandfather hid stuff in the wall. And then after the war, my grandfather went back and searched for it and didn't find it. And those stories, I have heard literally dozens of stories like that from individuals who say their grandfather or great-grandfather hid something in the walls or in the backyard. Has anyone ever found anything? I will say the epilogue in my book is when I encounter a man from Michigan who's there for the first time. And he has this kind of wild tale about his father-in-law hiding 10 golden eggs in the attic of the house he had lived in before the war in a city called Benjin. And so we went and we actually removed bricks. And, you know, I don't want to spoil the ending, but it's, you know, it's a dramatic moment when we actually remove that final brick to see whether these 10 golden eggs are there. I have seen photographic evidence of treasure hunters finding like golden nuggets that had been hidden for 70, 80 years. But have I heard any stories of like an individual going back? No, it tends to be something a little bit harder to hide, like, mm-hmm. Like a house or recovered artwork. No, I'm sure they're there, though. I just I haven't personally encountered them.
Right. Well, let's begin then with your story. Tell me about your family's property in Poland and what it was when the Nazis captured it and then the event that kicks off your story later on.
Sure. There's kind of two strands that thread together throughout the book. So one is my great-grandfather had an apartment building in a city called Sosnowiec. And then after the war, my grandfather had tried to reclaim that for about 40 years. This is something I never knew my grandfather. He died before I was born. And I wasn't really familiar with this narrative. And then I went to Poland kind of accidentally. I was just doing research. And then my father sort of kept mentioning this building that I should go visit. And I went to see it, and it was a pretty unsentimental encounter. But I kind of, on a whim, thought, you know, I saw the documents in the end. I thought, you know, this is kind of interesting. It seems like the documentation is surprisingly good. Like we had a mortgage register. And so I started those legal attempts to reclaim it. And this, just to give a little bit of context, so my great-grandfather was named Moshe Kaiser. So him, his wife, and two of his three children were all killed in the war. And so my grandfather was the only surviving member of his family. And then there was, we don't know how many cousins, but probably dozens. And as far as we knew, none had survived. And then the treasure hunter narrative kind of kicked off when in 2015, there was a lot of, and we could come back to this in a bit, but there was a great kind of media uproar over the fact that these two so-called Polish treasure hunters claimed to have found something called the Golden Train, which was this legendary train full of looted gold that was hidden inside of a mountain. And I was just kind of hanging around Poland, and I found this story to be really compelling. I was writing a novel at the time. I wanted to include it. And so I ended up hiring a sort of a guide to introduce me to some of these treasure hunters. And then when I met with them, they ended up, we were just kind of sitting around having a beer, and I ended up hearing my last name. Just, I heard Kaiser. You know, I don't speak Polish, but I heard them mention Kaiser repeatedly. When I asked who it was, they said, and there's this guy, Abraham Kaiser, and he'd written a diary while working as a slave laborer in some of these Nazi tunnels, something called Project Riza. And that diary turned out to be, because these tunnels have basically no primary documentation, this diary is turned into kind of a central document. And in turn, this guy, Abraham Kaiser, has become a mythological figure, like a really, really big deal among quite a significant subculture. And then it turned out that this man was the closest surviving relative of my grandfather's. And so once this discovery was made, once this connection, I kind of fell down that rabbit hole and entered the world of these treasure hunters or explorers, might be even a better term. And so that's kind of the thread of the book.
Yeah, and I want to come back to him definitely. But when you go to Poland, so you're writing the novel and you hear about your grandfather's cousin, then when you're trying to reclaim the family's apartment building in Poland, your Holocaust surviving grandfather, what's that process like? Where do you show up? Fighting a legal battle in a country with a foreign language, I imagine, is a tricky affair.
It started as, I didn't really hold out any attempt for it actually to work, to be honest. I just found it sort of an interesting entry into, I'm just interested in the questions, really, that I was able to ask or maybe even write about. And so I got a lawyer on a recommendation, and she goes by The Killer. That is her go-to nickname. So we hired The Killer and we started on the claim. So basically there was two things that had to happen. One was we had to establish the family tree in the legal record because everyone had been wiped out. So we needed everyone's death certificate. So my great grandfather and his wife and two of those children, the heirs of the building, had essentially disappeared from the legal record. So what we had to do is sort of go to the court, petition the court to recognize their deaths and give us that death certificate, which would establish my grandfather as the heir. And the second sort of legal front was just saying, hey, this building that used to be owned by my great-grandfather is still owned by my great-grandfather, and therefore that line of inheritance should be established. Right now, or when I began, technically the building was ownerless. No one could buy it or sell it because there were no owners. So we had to update, so to speak, the registry from pre-war to post-war. That second part is pretty pro forma. The first part ended up being really tricky. The court kept rejecting our appeals. And so basically it became this very surreal experience of having the courts tell me effectively that my great grandparents weren't dead. And even though they'd be between 130, 140 years old. And there was a lot of twists, and it turns out the question was how ungenerous and how stingy was the judge being versus did we file the wrong claim? But I was in this for a couple of years, this very strange space of asking the courts to recognize the deaths of my dead relatives and we kept appealing. We nearly took it to the Supreme Court and we kept getting no. But that was solved eventually, but it took a very long time.
You're describing a lot of life as foreigners in a different country where it seems like an endless string of bureaucratic offices and confusing paperwork and motions and counter motions. So kudos to your persistence. This is another thing I wonder when you're describing going back to this building. I've heard a few cases where maybe somebody who leaves Europe as a small child, escaping the Holocaust, decades and decades and decades later, they return to their old village and there's maybe a daughter or grandmother of a resident there saying, oh, you look like this family here. And there's, even though there's a vast gulf of time, there's still a faint sense of homecoming. Did you have anything like that when you were going back to the building of, oh, I am the granddaughter of this tenant, and I remember hearing stories of this family member or anything like that?
Yeah. Here's the thing. Everything gets so murky and tricky. So when I first went, before I started the legal claim, I found it to be a very unsentimental encounter. When I went back after I had restarted the legal claim, my sort of relationship to the property changed. And then my relationship to the people who lived there changed. And I felt duty-bound to meet them. That was sort of an appreciation that took a long time. But I realized that what I was doing, whether I was successful or not, was going to really impact the residents. And so I did not want to be sort of a foreign, distant, abstract presence. I didn't think that would be fair or right or moral. And so I went into the building and I kind of met everyone. And I was in this like morally precarious place where how honest should I be? And eventually I told them, none of them knew the name. None of them knew who I was. None of them knew anything. And it was very kind of rich. The history of the building was unbelievably rich. And like during communist times, it had been designated as the property for the local provincial theater. So everyone in the building was connected with the theater in some way, where directors or actors, administrator, and even now, post-communist, it's still true. Like everyone has a legacy of theater there. And then it turned out that I was in the wrong building, that there had been a typo and the addresses had shifted. And so it was just like another, every strand is sort of like you go in and you don't really know what's happening. And you don't really know that you don't know. And then that sort of my world got turned upside down. And then I started to really, to your question, really, you start really questioning like your relationship and your sentimental relationship when it turns out everything you thought is wrong. And then I sort of had to rebuild that with the new building. And I was starting from scratch. And that became a whole new question of like, what is my relationship to the building after I felt this last building, it's going to quote unquote betrayed me. Like that connection turned out to be hollow. And so I don't have a direct answer, but I'm saying it's something that I struggled with the entire time and continue to struggle with today. Of like, how do you interact with the building, with the people who live there?
And I'm curious, in your interactions with people, even if you weren't explicitly saying, you know, I am a distant relation of somebody who was killed in the Holocaust, I'm sure there's a lot of people there who could read between the lines and figure out, okay, this is an American descendant of someone who left and there's no death certificate. They could probably put it together. And this is dredging up a very painful past. And the people who are there, they're in this strange gray area where it upsets their life if they give up property, but somebody could accuse them, well, you're expropriating somebody's property of which it was taken from them wrongly, but they didn't decide to do this. They were just born into it. It happened long before they were born. So really, what was it like interacting with people and when this is getting into a very tricky pass and it's just really not clear what to do?
I think, again, it's just such a morally precarious and tricky place. And I started, like, I would say the default attitude, like where I started from, was one of, There wasn't any like morally tricky, like to me, it was like morally clear cut as like what was ours remains ours. But then you start meeting people who live there and you realize like sort of how naive and how shallow an attitude that really is. There is a trope, certainly there's a trope in Poland of the Jew coming back for his property. A lot of this is an unfair borderline anti-Semitic stereotype that, you know, there's like, it's grossly disproportionate to actually happen. It's used as a boogeyman. It keeps coming up in elections. It's a national issue with like national political ramifications of what to do with this property. And so Warsaw has its own very complicated narrative of how they've tried to deal with it, the rest of the country too. And there hasn't been a proper reckoning. It's one of the few countries that hasn't actually passed any restitution laws. And so my case in particular isn't a restitution law, it was an inheritance claim. We were saying we still own the property. There was no antagonist. We weren't trying to take it from anyone. So the people who lived in the building didn't own the building. They were paying rent. I think this would have been a very different, much more complicated case and situation, one which I don't know if I would have had the chutzpah to pursue if I had to take it away from someone. Interact, you know, the older people tended to be very suspicious, didn't want to talk to me. I felt kind of ashamed. I felt like an intruder in a lot of ways. And I kind of went back and forth. And it's very hard to extricate like kind of how you feel about it to how you're being treated. And so like when I felt like I was being mistreated by the courts, I felt more antagonistic. And that's not fair, but it's kind of human nature. But eventually, you know, the people I did meet and did connect to were just unbelievably warm. I will say in that first building, before I knew it was the wrong building, I met a woman named Hannah. Anna Dobievsky. And in like this kind of weird, strange coincidence, Anna Dobievsky is probably the greatest expert on Sosnovyej real estate in the world. Someone who had spent her entire life as an architect, whose father was a city planner, who had dozens of professional grade maps that even City Hall didn't have. And she was so open and so helpful. And so like the interaction we had were very meaningful. Again, this was all in the wrong building. And I sort of had to restart from scratch. But you'll find everything. You'll find sort of deep mistrust and suspicion, which I understand. You get it. When someone's lived somewhere for 60 years and sort of the origins of their home are really murky and it's kind of don't go there, there's a sort of security that's going to be in question all the time. And, as a foreigner, and particularly as a Jew, I represent the threat. And, you just don't have answers, but I think it's really important to sort of embrace that complexity to the extent we're able to and sort of have the narrative encompass like all the parties. And it's unfortunately pretty rare. I think the default attitude is very antagonistic. My property, your property, rather than like a story, which just people are in different parts of it. And I wish I had better answers, but it remains like very tricky to navigate.
Hey everyone, Scott here. We're going to take a very short break for a word from our sponsors.
Well, just to zoom out a little bit before getting back to your story, I'm curious that what you mentioned earlier, the trope in Poland of the returning Jew, somebody coming from overseas to take things. There's sort of a similar thing in Turkey, where I lived for a long time, that after the Armenian genocide of 1915, where up to 1.5 million Armenians were killed, there was a lot of land, a lot of property, and a lot of other things that fell into the hands of the Ottoman government and later the Turkish Republic. In southeastern Turkey, a similar thing with the property of Syriani Christians. And today, the Armenian genocide is not recognized by the Turkish government. And some historians have wondered, what do they have to lose by recognizing it? Because this happened over a century ago. It's not like the property is going to be given to the Republic of Armenia. The legal claim of descendants of them would be so tenuous that it would be almost unenforceable in court because it happened under foreign government, yada, yada. But one historian argued, well, the bogeyman is more that the Republic of Turkey, maybe it's more of a subconscious thing, and this isn't on the level of your average citizen, of course, but we've been wronged as well, where Muslims in foreign lands, in Russia, in the Balkans, they were wrong. Their property was taken and we accepted refugees. But we're being criticized for things that other nations don't have to own up to. So we're just not being treated fairly in the International Court of Public Opinion. So for not recognizing the Armenian genocide back then, it's more of contemporary politics of we get picked on in a way other people don't. And the trope, like you said, in Poland of the returning Jew, that sounds like such a marginal thing. It's so small that there's very, very low likelihood of that happening to someone. But where do you think the trope comes from? Is it a Polish person thinking, I'm being forced to deal with things that happened long before I was born, and I'm still being punished for something that someone else did a long time ago? Or where do you think that is?
Well, I will say it happens. Like, there is absolutely people who reclaim property. And I will say, just to zoom out a tiny bit, in the late 90s, a law was passed in Poland giving back communal property to the Jewish community. And that represents a tremendous amount, hundreds of millions of dollars worth in major cities all across Poland. So there absolutely, property has been transferred. None of those, generally speaking, people don't live in those buildings. They're like old schools or synagogues, but often they have been converted to apartments. So it does exist. And it's something that gets seized upon. And I think there's a cynical part to it for sure. I think it's Jews in Poland are like a very easy other. It's a very small population today. It's something, especially as the government has gotten more right wing, that they can use as a bogeyman. And they can sort of appeal to like a nationalist spirit, which has a very long history in Poland. But it's also not that long ago. And so I think, you know, you have people alive today who live in an apartment, say, in either Sosnovyej or in Krakow or in Warsaw, who, like, the history of that apartment, it's, they're people alive and in their memory doesn't belong to them. And so I think there is like a fear. I think there's like a certain insecurity that could come with that, and that will come out either in like political or cultural tropes. And I will say, it's like, I do know more than a few people who have successfully reclaimed property. And often these properties are very central and extremely valuable. So you have, there's someone I know in Krakow who took one like in the city square, and it's got to be at least a $10 million property. And so I think anyone, time like someone does something like that, it's going to bring stuff up. And I think it's, on one hand, again, like it's an easy scapegoat. It's sort of a punching bag. Another two, yeah, I just, there's a tremendous amount of displacement. You know, in the western part of the country, there's all this forced immigration. So like they took that east, but became Ukraine, something like a million Poles were forcibly migrated to the west. So a lot of people found themselves in new homes. And like deeper, like kind of what you were saying too, this idea of victimization, like who are the victims? And in a place like Poland, it's very, very complicated. Polish people feel rightly that they were victims of World War II. And then the Jewish narrative is often seen at odds with that. And so this is something that this kind of front, this kind of battle is going to find its way into like all the different arenas. And property just is kind of the most material one that still has resonance today.
Well, shifting gears a little bit, you mentioned earlier your grandfather's cousin, Abraham Kaiser. He wrote a secret memoir while he was a slave laborer in a Nazi tunnel complex. So first, can you tell me about this? What is this tunnel complex? What was your grandfather's cousin doing there? How did he survive? And what was this memoir? Just really curious about this.
So there's this thing called, the complex is called Project Riza. And Project Riza is seven tunnels. And possibly there are more, but seven that we know of that were sort of discovered in the 50s and 60s and 70s around near, all kind of centered around the city called Wajek in Silesia, which is in the southwest. And these tunnels, none of them were finished, and so they're all in various stages of completion. The ones that are closer to being completed are enormous. So they're not tunnels sort of undersells it. These are complexes. We're talking multiple stories, square kilometers of area, but just like the rooms are football field sized, 20 meter high ceilings. And there are seven plants. The smallest ones, the ones that aren't anywhere near completed, do feel like tunnels, like they were just starting the foundation. Now, what becomes like really compelling and enigmatic about Project Riza is that there's virtually no primary documentation. So we don't have any sort of good sources of what the Nazis were planning to do with these. And because of the lack of documentation, these have kind of taken a really strong grip on like the treasure hunter imagination. So you have a tremendous amount of conspiracy theories, strange things. Realistically, Nazis, when they built their undergrounds, we do have a pretty good idea of what they did. Generally, they were factories or underground or bunkers or a combination of the two. So that's most likely what they were. But when you do go into the tunnels, it does kind of break your brain a little bit. You're like, what are these things? Three, maybe, or four now are open to the public. The rest you could get to if you know what you're doing. Now, these tunnels were built using slave labor, mostly Jewish, from the Gross Rosen concentration camp network. I don't have the numbers off it. I think about 15,000 slave laborers died building the tunnels, which again, it complicates like sort of how we interact with the tunnels, because they are, I call them in the book, a testament to mass murder. Even though there's this sort of like very sexy, mysterious thing, you want to keep the idea that this is also a site of tragedy in mind. So my Abraham Kaiser, my grandfather's cousin, was a slave labor. And in these camps, there were seven, there were eight, I think there was eight of these sub camps were dedicated to the construction of the tunnels. And there was a tremendous amount of movement. So he worked in almost all of them, and he was moved around, and he wrote a memoir using like a stolen pencil stub on scraps of concrete packaging. And he kept this, you know, he writes in the memoir how before he left, he would hide it underneath the latrine. And then after the war, he escaped from the camp in April of 1945, and he was taken in by a German woman. And then when the war was over, he borrowed a bicycle and went to all the individual camps and retrieved these cement scraps. Then he brought it to an editor, a Polish editor, and in the early 60s, the diary was released. And it's a diary which sort of, the reason like the treasure hunters take it as seriously and place all the value on it is because he records. He said, like, you know, it seems some of it very banal. He's like, I'm in the forest, there's this company, we're working on this this part of the tunnel, which entrance. So it's kind of mined for clues with these kind of very mysterious tunnels, Project Riza.
Has his disclosures or descriptions led to people finding anything in the complex?
I don't think so. But I think part of it is that they're just, there's so little of good documentation about these tunnels. That this is sort of, if you're interested in Project Riza, you start with Abram Kuyper's memoir. It's kind of like the one agreed upon text.
Right, because otherwise you're just trying to guess what was going on there. But if it's in different stages of completion, you really don't know. So that's very interesting.
Yeah, the treasure hunters and the guys particularly who are involved in Riza, they don't see themselves as exploiters for the most part. They sort of see themselves as you know, historians, or sort of like as guardians of history. And so they take it more seriously. So they're not just like looking at the tunnels and seeing if like there's empty bullet casings or hidden things, although some of them are, or some of them are genuine parts, but they to varying degrees, they see themselves as the history is not immaterial to them. And so it's important. Like this memoir that it exists is important to them. So it takes on even like, not just the material that's within the book, it takes on like a higher resonance.
Well, I know that you don't want to completely spoil the ending of your book, but I'm always, as much as I think you're happy to disclose here while still leaving listeners tantalized for more, is there a conclusion to talking with a building residents about trying to restore a family legacy? And is there a way that this comes together and wraps up?
Yes, but I will say it doesn't conclude. It concludes with not that I get it back or that I don't get it back, but sort of an embracing of the uncertainty, which sounds a little cliche, but I sort of accidentally stumbled onto a truer ending by the fact that I was frustrated in my attempts.
Right. I mean, because I think a lot of this explores these questions of trying to deal with the past when there's not clear right and wrong, because we're all just trying to deal with the fallout and rebuild our lives. This isn't, you know, Allied soldiers versus Nazis, where it is very clear good versus evil, because in the descendants of this, when we're trying to live in these gray zones, it's not. So I don't know, just speaking in general with this story, can you say anything coming away from this of what it means to try to seize your own legacy, and can reclaimed property repair rifts among the living, or do you think there are some divisions that are still not be able to be bridged?
Yeah, I think when I began the book, or I began this attempt, I think there was a tremendous amount of focus and emphasis on the building itself as a symbol, as something like, I'm going to get back and I'm going to sort of fulfill my mission. I'm going to quote unquote win.
Right.
And I think the deeper I got in and sort of the trickier it got, and like the more loops I was thrown for, and sort of like the more setbacks, I think you start understanding that it is a symbol. I think we often, like, especially when we're doing legacy stuff, I think we get a little bit obsessed with symbols and we place too much emphasis and forget that they stand for something rather than for themselves. And so I think where I was led ultimately was confront the idea. I think I was so focused on this building and it's a mission, and like missions are very, you know, you get very into them. You know, it's like, I got to do this and I got to do this and I'm going to win. I'm going to like beat the final boss. But that's what I was forced to really reckon with. It's like the idea of what is the building? And so what does it mean to me? And then you're sort of forced to reckon with like, what is my relationship to my grandfather? And like, what, and like, am I continuing his efforts? And so, or and this is something a little bit more complicated. Because I didn't know him. And I think, especially when we deal with stuff that is sentimentally heavy, I think there's sort of like very familiar lines that we could fall into of like, I'm doing this, it's so meaningful, I'm a grandson continuing his grandfather's legacy. But the fact that I was so frustrated and that there were so many roadblocks meant I kind of had to really define that for myself, which ultimately I'm very grateful for, because I think it brought me to like a much more honest place of sort of grappling like who my grandfather was. And like at the end of the day, this is not a spoiler, I don't learn much about him. You know, the irony is I learned much more about Abraham Kaiser than they did about my own grandfather. But it was like an earned ignorance, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And so, yeah, I would say my main takeaway, like that it doesn't become sort of a binary mission of like fail or succeed, but rather like a real probe of like these ideas and symbols and relationships.
These types of questions, I think, really are served well by personal memoirs when there isn't a clear hero and villain. So I think this is a really useful way to explore this for people who want to check out more. And for those who do, the name of the book is Plunder, a memoir of family property and Nazi treasure. So really interesting story, a lot more to dig out of it. And Menachem, thank you for joining us and sharing all this with us.
Sure. Thanks so much, Scott. It was a pleasure.
Okay, well, that wraps things up for today's episode. Thank you so much for sticking with me to the end. Once again, I want to start things off by thanking the Spymasters of History Unplugged. I'll explain what that is in a second. Our Spymasters include Bill Ivey, Moondoggy from Ohio, Tom from Ohio, Ryan Gillen, Rob from Chicago, Nick Brooks, Michael from New York, Carl from Norway, Josh Reddick, Jennifer French Lee, Jay Carrington, McCrays, Salvador Sanchez, David Santee, Chris C., and Baron Fraser. If you'd like to support the show, there's some very easy ways to do so. First, go to the site halfpricehistory.com. I've worked out an arrangement with a lot of the authors who've appeared on this show, and you can go there and get their books for 50% off. All you have to do is go to halfpricehistory.com and enter the promo code UNPLUGGED at checkout. Second, please leave a review and subscribe to this podcast on your favorite podcast player of choice, whether Apple Podcasts or Spotify or Stitcher or whatever. Third, join our Facebook group. You can go to Facebook and search for History Unplugged. There, you can talk with other fans of the show about recent episodes, what you liked, what you didn't like. Also, I have exclusive content there, such as live streams, where I do live versions of podcast episodes, where you can leave feedback as I'm talking, and I will address it on air. Last, and I think this is the best, is to join our membership program, the Knowlton's Rangers. The Knowlton's Rangers were George Washington's spies during the Revolutionary War, but it's also the name of the membership program for History Unplugged. If you go to patreon.com/unplugged, you can join the membership program at three levels. If you join at the Scout level, you'll get all 400 episodes of History Unplugged absolutely ad-free and early access to new episodes. If you join at the second level, the Intelligence Officer level, get all the stuff that Scouts get, along with bonus episodes. There's currently about 40 of them, including series on Audie Murphy and Operation Long Jump about the Nazi attempt to assassinate FDR, Churchill, and Stalin in 1943. Finally, if you join at the Spymaster level, you'll get a shout out to you and or your business at the end of each episode. You get a 3-pack of hardcover history books, and you can find out what those are if you go to patreon.com/unplugged. Finally, you can ask me a question about history on absolutely any topic on earth, and I will research it and devote an entire episode to your question. Probably about 30% of the questions in the archive for the show have been based on these sorts of questions. So there you go. Go to patreon.com/unplugged to learn more. All right, well, that is all for today's episode. Thank you so much for listening, and I'll see you next time.